Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. This is National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN.org. This is usually where I would show for donations for RBN, but today I'm going to show for donations to Tulsi Gabbard, and just a dollar or $5 or whatever. But I know Mark Dankoff and I were probably among the first people to start talking about her in our circles. Mark, do you remember? It was right after the November 2016 election. We were suggesting that Trump should choose her as Secretary of State. And, of course, we've got Mike Pompeo, so I guess we have nothing to complain about, right?
Well, that's exactly right. We have plenty to complain about, and certainly at least in terms of foreign policy, with the things that she has said, Tulsi Gabbard would have been a major improvement as a Secretary of State. And we had made it clear, you and I had made it clear from the beginning, that with all of the names that were being bandied about at that time, her name did come up with the Trump people. But she wasn't selected for anything, much less Secretary of State. But obviously, when you start looking at people like Pompeo and Bolton, who surround the president, and people like Elliot Abrams now engaging in his nefarious activities again in Venezuela, we certainly could use Tulsi Gabbard as Secretary of State. And this gets into some bigger
issues. Oh, the Secretary of Defense job is open, too. And
what's that?
Secretary of Defense job is open right now, too. I mean, it's open.
Somebody gets to administer that $750 billion boondoggle that we have going.
Yeah. And so if somebody did want to contribute, I'm just going to say it's Tulsi 2020, TULSI2020.com, Tulsi2020.com. You give a dollar. Yeah, they take your name, but there's no harm in having your name associated with Tulsi Gabbard. You're not going to get a knock on the door for being a white nationalist by giving to a lady from Hawaii. And that's all she needs is a dollar. And if we get enough of these donations, I don't know if the deadline is tonight, and of course the show won't air until tomorrow, or if it's the next day, but there might be the deadline for the June debate, but there's another one in July, so we got to get her on the stage. But sorry to interrupt.
No, that's fine. And basically this dovetails into some things that we will discuss on the big board when we cover a few of the news items that are presently there, including one that I'm about to put up here even as we speak. But Tulsi Gabbard clearly seems to be on the right side of this overall American foreign policy picture as it relates to foreign intervention everywhere in the world, as it relates to all of these military involvements and coup d'etats and so forth. As we've discussed previously on this show and other ones, she's less clear about who it is that's behind all of this bad foreign policy than, say, we would be. But nonetheless, when you compare her certainly to Pompeo or to Bolton or to Elliot Abrams or to virtually anyone else running in the Democratic Party primaries for president, she would certainly, if I was a Democrat, which I'm not, if I were voting in the Democratic Party primaries, she would be my choice on the basis of the foreign policy alone. Mm. Social issues are another matter, but that's true of all of the other Democratic presidential contenders. But just sticking to the foreign policy focus, she clearly, for those of us who feel the way that we do on these issues from the right, clearly would be with us on that, maybe a little less explicit than we would be on that.
Yeah,
but
a lot less explicit, but
fine.
A lot less explicit, but still, compared to the current trajectory and the past trajectory of American foreign policy, very much moving things in the right direction, in a better direction.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah, so that's Tulsi2020.com. And so I will do that shilling instead of my usual shilling for the Co-Certified app, which is still lots of fun. But I'll show for that tomorrow.
Very good.
Okay, so we've got a bunch of stuff that when we talk about the big board, we're talking about nationalbugle.com. And if you're still going to the Drudge Report, come on, okay? go to nationalbugle.com. If you want a news amalgamation site, that's where you're going to find much more interesting stories than on Drudge. Yeah. Well, how about the Israeli election? Do you have something up there about that yet?
Yeah, I've got a couple of things up there on that that were written prior to yesterday, including one I'm going to post. Cook, this comes from his own website. Antiwar.com ran with this in the last couple of days. It's one of their premier stories. It's entitled Netanyahu and Gantz are two sides of the same coin. I think that that's clearly demonstrable, especially when you read what it is that Jonathan Cook has to say about this today. One thing I find to be absolutely fascinating, if you wanted to make a joke about this election, you could well nigh say, if you're a Zionist Jew living in Israel and you have a choice between a warmonger and a war criminal and a crook on the one hand, and a warmonger and a war criminal who's not a crook in his personal ethics on the other, who would you choose?
I think I choose the crook.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, in this particular case, Israel went both with the warmonger and the war criminal and the crook. He has all three of those attributes. So Benny Gantz apparently lost in a very, very close election. I have yet to see the final totals on the Knesset composition. Obviously, Netanyahu will form a coalition that be his coalition. But the people that don't like Netanyahu, which is a pretty significant number in Israel now, for reasons in many cases related to not necessarily his ideas about going to war with Iran, but just the fact that they know he's a conniving, wallet-expanding crook, they will be properly represented with a significant number of seats in the Knesset, certainly. So you're going to have 120 seats in the Knesset. Who knows how that breaks down between Bibi and the boys, on the one hand, the people he will control in the coalition, and those who are not with Bibi. But it should be a pretty reasonable representation for the forces that were not happy with Netanyahu being elected. But nonetheless, we can say with all assurance that the warmonger, war criminal, and crook has just been re-elected by the skin of his teeth, beating a guy who is both a warmonger and a war criminal, but who is apparently at least not a crook. So the crook wins, and in this particular case, it's Netanyahu once again. And this begs the question as to the larger issues that we can also get into in the big board as to what's going on in our foreign policy. And all of the new people, or at least newer people, to what we've been saying for years, you and I, Pat Buchanan, Phil Giraldi, David Duke, and such folks, diverse as we are maybe in our own political ways, but we've all agreed that these wars involve Israel and Israeli political and racial supremacy. That particular doctrine, as it operates both in Israel and among Israel's fifth column in the United States, and that this is chiefly the one thing, of course, that Tulsi doesn't talk about too much, if at all, and is the Israeli angle.
Yeah, and
I
want to get back to that. I just want to make a couple comments. And yeah, you can't expect. I mean, she's not going to talk about it. Don't really expect her to talk about it, but. Here's the thing about Benny Gantz. I've heard his name. Yeah, I knew he was a general and all that. But I don't know anything in particular about him, other than, just like you can't expect Tulsi Gabbard to talk about Jewish power in the United States, you can't expect anybody who would favor any kind of just resolution with the Palestinians. You can't expect anybody like that to get anywhere in Israeli politics. So if somebody's in a neck-and-neck race with Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, given the Israeli electorate, you know that the person is just, they're a war criminal, maybe with, you know, like a different hood ornament, but they're still a war criminal. And I remember when Zippy Livni, who was, she looked like she was about to become the next prime minister, and she lost an election to Netanyahu back in 2009. But had she come on, there would have been this whole thing, oh, we've got some wonderful person here, and there's going to be, negotiations, and we can move the peace process forward. And the peace process has not been a peace process. It's just been, what do you call it? When you just grind people down, you grind them down. It's an expropriation process. It is my thesaurus isn't working today, but when you're stealing things, when you're grinding people down, it's an attrition process, basically. And they're just taking and taking. And had Benny Gantz become the prime minister, it would have been, the Beto O'Rourke people who are calling Netanyahu a racist, which I find kind of fun that he's saying that. But it would be, there's a new day in Israel, and this is wonderful, and we got rid of the Israeli Trump. And no, there wouldn't be any change. Just like there was, people used to build up Shimon Peres, the left-wing labor guy. And no, he was no peacenik. It was always the same. So frankly, I think people know who Netanyahu is, and better the Netanyahu you know than the Netanyahu you don't know. Does that sound reasonable?
Let me read just a little bit of this that Jonathan Cook tells us in regard to Gantz. And I'll preface this by saying that in terms of Beto O'Rourke, and I believe at the time we posted this on National Bugle Radio, and I believe statistics came from the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, but Beto O'Rourke, when he was in the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives, in recent times was getting more money from the Israeli lobby than anyone else in the House. So this is curious because of the things he said in more recent times
with
Netanyahu.
Sorry to interrupt, but I think in his recent run against Ted Cruz, that he spent more money in a Senate campaign than anybody ever in American history. I think he did.
Yes.
And we know that was largely Jewish money.
Exactly. And I think there's a bigger message in this, folks, for all of you who are listening on RBN or will hear this show when it's reposted in social media and so forth, wherever it goes. You cannot trust the left or the Jewish American left when it comes to Israel, because this O'Rourke thing is a classic example of it, where you have a circumstance where this guy is trying to pander to Americans who are tired of war. He is trying to pander to people who are buying into the demonization of Netanyahu, but who don't understand the larger circumstances that surround the Zionist state, who do not understand its origins, how it was found, by whom, and for what ultimate purposes, and that ultimately, I criticize as well these so-called Jewish leftists who have all of these things that sound good, but that end up being extremely suspicious when you start examining the closer record. Medea Benjamin and the Jewish Voice for Peace people and Code Pink, all of this comes to the fore when they are critical of those of us on the American nationalist right for a variety of reasons, including the fact that we tend to support a traditional older Christian value system on social issues. They don't like that. Mm-hmm. But inevitably, those on the Jewish left who have tried to push for some type of two-state solution to this Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it all sounds good, right? In principle, it sounds like, hey, maybe it's a workable deal. We can't go back and undo what happened during the Nakba, certainly. But what we can do is at least ensure that with this whole tragedy having been facilitated, we can come up with a two-state solution that at least stops any further bloodshed, that in theory at least, and that avoids the potential for larger superpower involvement in a war that is in no one's interest. So in principle, it all sounds good, and yet when you look at the real record of people like Bernie Sanders, his voting record when he was in and still is in the U.S. Senate, it all sounds good. When you start looking more closely at some of his votes, he is not the pristine candidate of the anti-war left
the way one
would think.
Right.
And O'Rourke certainly is, we already know that he's a fraud, but certainly with taking all of these millions of dollars, much of it from Jewish sources, and then playing in this political theater, this controlled opposition, this fake dialectic that we get into between Democrat and Republican, he certainly, O'Rourke, is playing into all of this beautifully in what he is saying about Netanyahu. And yet, nonetheless, the dollar figures tell there that when push comes to shove, whether he's in the House of Representatives or whether he would eventually be elected president of the United States, which I think is absolutely terrifying. There's some many other Democrats I don't like either, who at least I think are sane. At least they're leftists, but they're not just crazy. And I think this guy O'Rourke is clearly not playing with a complete and full deck of cards. I don't think he's ever going to be elected to the White House. But
is he playing with a pinochle deck or what?
Yes. If he were to be elected as president of the United States, all of these leftists who think that they are solving world problems in the Middle East by voting for him will find out otherwise, and I think the dollar figures underscore that. But Jonathan Cook's article entitled Netanyahu and Gantz are Two Sides of the Same Coin, antiwar.com ran with this, but we produced it from Jonathan's own site. And this originally was published by The National on the 7th of April. Jonathan Cook goes on to tell us what we already know just briefly, that Netanyahu, of course, is a crook. But he goes on in discussing Gantz. Netanyahu, of course, has been engaged in some incredible campaign tactics. I don't know how many of us even know about any of this because mainstream media, for the most part, isn't talking about it. But apparently, according to Jonathan Cook, Netanyahu has had officials saying that Benny Gantz, a general Netanyahu once appointed as military chief of staff, is mentally unstable. One Likud video showed Gantz's head emerging from a cuckoo clock. The character assassination has been aided by the leaking of a recording of an off-guard Gantz saying that if he could have done so, Netanyahu would have had him killed. Netanyahu's team also exploited and possibly leaked a claim that Gantz's mobile phone was hacked by Iran. If he couldn't protect his own phone, how will he protect our country, Netanyahu has said, and so forth and so on. Now, then we get into Gantz himself, who heads the Blue and White Party. He hardly emerges spotless, Cook tells us. Gantz has steeped himself in dubious military glory with ads showing footage of the devastation in Gaza that he presided over, a bombing spree that killed more than 500 children. The video bragged about Gantz sending the enclave, quote-unquote, back to the Stone Age. And then as we go on to read the rest of this, we understand that this Blue and White party that Gantz ran at the head of that, there are two other high-powered generals unnamed in the Cook piece who were working with Gantz in this attempt to get rid of Netanyahu. Cook characterizes this as the Israeli security establishment's effort to get rid of Bibi, who is seen as squandered international goodwill with his public intransigence on peacemaking. Mm-hmm. We might turn around and say at least the guy's honest about what he's doing,
yeah,
right?
I'm just going to interject. Could you imagine being an American Jew, like so many American Jews, who on the one hand are going to turn a blind eye or justify massive, you know, indiscriminate bombing in Gaza, killing hundreds and hundreds of children, or shooting at anybody who gets within a couple hundred meters of this wall that you've built, on the one hand, and then kvetching about Donald Trump talking about building a wall or separating families who come over illegally into the country. Well, we're coming up on the break. I'll just let that sit, and we'll be right back.
And we got something to discuss at that point. Good. Yep. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. So, Mark, I left you with that thought of the American Jew who might even want to think of Benny. I guess this is the J Street take on it. Might want to think of Benny Gantz as being, you know, the peace candidate, but given.
Well. As Jonathan Cook puts it, this is a straightforward slugging match between the right-wing Gantz and the far right-wing Netanyahu. That's at least Cook's take on this.
Yeah, right-wing, right-wing.
This is a straightforward slugging match between the two of them. Both certainly continue to favor these illegal settlements on Palestinian territory. There's the Gantz record in Gaza, certainly, that he's actually running on, as if he's proud of this sort of thing. And what I think is Gantz's quote during the campaign speech, his very first inaugural campaign speech, is saying that he would, quote, strengthen the settlement blocks, unquote, as well as, quote, retain control of security in the entire land of Israel, unquote, which includes the West Bank and Gaza. Gantz has repeatedly evaded questions about what solution he proposes for the Palestinians. But like, and this to me was the key paragraph before we bring Natalie Portman into this, whose article today, or the article about Natalie, is up there on the
big board. She's a Hollywood actress, right?
Yes. And
Jewish,
she's a liberal,
right?
Zionist, but why she has... You know, she emphasizes that she was, right? And we'll discuss that in just a moment. But nonetheless, Gantz, along with these other Israeli security officials who were trying to dislodge Netanyahu, Gantz believes it is important, says Jonathan Cook, for Israel to court the West by giving the appearance of a willingness to negotiate. The appearance, doesn't matter whether or not it's actually real, just the appearance. And this, to me, I think, is the heart of this big board. But quite clearly, you will see that in this election, the Israelis were voting for some version of the usual situation. And, of course, Trump has made it very clear that he was on board with everything that Bibi was doing and is doing. In this entire thing that involves Israel and the settlements and East Jerusalem and this whole thing with Iran, which is very, very disturbing business, obviously. But this is where we get into Natalie Portman and the story about Mondo Weiss.
Now, is Natalie Portman, is she just Jewish, or is she Israeli, or is she Jewish-Australian? What is she?
Well, let's see here. Let me read a bit of this. It should tell us. This comes to us from Robert Cohen of Mondo Weiss, and it's entitled, Dear Natalie Portman, I too was once a liberal Zionist. And in this particular situation, Robert Cohen, as it is Natalie Portman, this is apparently, as I drew it, a letter that Cohen wrote Natalie Portman, to pretty much to that effect. I too was once a liberal Zionist. Now, we are told Natalie Portman is quoted on Friday, the 20th of April last year, as saying, quote, Israel was created exactly 70 years ago as a haven for refugees from the Holocaust. We might tell Natalie that there were plenty of people ranging from William E. Blackstone to the Jewish founder of Zionism that is they credit with the founding of Zionism, Theodore Herzl. They were working on all of this in the 19th century, which was a long time before the so-called Holocaust, right? But this is what Natalie is saying. But the mistreatment of those suffering from Jewish values. Because I care about Israel, I must stand up against violence, corruption, inequality, and abuse of power. We might well say, hey, Natalie, that's what the Zionist state has been erected upon ever since its inception, right? And when you have such stellar figures as Benjamin Netanyahu today, how is he different? How in the world is he different from Menachem Begin? How is he different from Yitzhak Shamir? How is he different from some of the people that were being used in the Zionist gun-running movement of that time, ranging from Meyer Lansky, the head of the Israeli crime syndicate in the United States? So basically what you have here is Portman, Natalie Portman. Doing an honorable thing, by the way, and this gentleman, Robert Cohen, reminds us of it in this article in Mondo Weiss, that Natalie made a decision to snub the so-called Genesis Prize, and that is because of all the things that Bibi and company have been doing in Israel that virtually cause any reasonable person to shudder. Now, having said that, Natalie apparently doesn't know anything of the original history of the founding of Zionism or how many people were at work in it, ranging from the Christian Zionist William E. Blackstone to the founder of Zionism himself, Theodor Herzl, in the late 19th century, who headed up the first World Jewish Congress, I believe, on this matter. Mm-hmm. But this then gets into all these other things that we were briefly mentioning. Harold Lansky was a bigwig in helping gun running into pre-statehood Palestine. Mm-hmm. You had thugs like Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir involved in this, including, of course, yep. Begin's famous bombing of the King David Hotel.
Which won him a Nobel Prize, by the way.
Won him a Nobel Prize for doing that. And then, of course,
we're coming right up on the break, so let's talk about this on the other side of the break.
Sure.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and the new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future. Thank you. We are back. So yeah, Menachem Begin, Nobel Prize winner, and the mastermind behind the bombing of the King David Hotel, which killed how many people? It was British and whoever else was there. It was the British headquarters of their government in Palestine before it got ripped apart.
Yes, exactly. And of course, you had underlings involved in this that turn up at later stages in American history. Jacob Rubinstein, a.k.a.
Oh, wait
Jack
a minute. Jacob Rubinstein. Yeah, Jack Ruby. So yeah. What was his connection to, say, Menachem Begin?
Well, Jack Ruby was involved in an organization in Texas. People can look this up on Google. It may still be there. The Sonneborn Institute, I believe, was the name of it. Mike Piper.
And for our non-boomer listeners, Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald on live TV. Was that the day of the Kennedy assassination or the next day?
Kennedy was assassinated on Friday, November 22nd. This occurred Sunday morning, the 24th.
But on live TV, right?
What's that?
It was on live TV, wasn't it?
I saw it at the time it happened on live television. I was 8 years old. My brother was 12. We saw it live when Ruby shot Oswald with a .38 right in the gut as the so-called transfer was underway. Lee Harvey Oswald to yet another facility. So at any rate, isn't it interesting, especially against the backdrop of Michael Collins Piper's Final Judgment and what Lawrence Guyanot has written about Israel and the death of the Kennedys that's available in the UNS Review, which is still on our big board, that when you start looking at the larger picture of what happened to Kennedy, this leads back to some very familiar people like Mayansky. And it also leads to other crime figures connected to Lansky, who, like Mickey Cohen, who was the go-between at the introduction of Marilyn Monroe to Jack Kennedy. So there you have these links to what happened to Jack Kennedy that are more appropriately chronicled in Mike Piper's book, again, Final Judgment, Lawrence Guyanot's piece on the Israeli link to both Kennedy deaths that's mentioned in the UNS Review. We still have that up on the big board. But getting back now to this piece by this gentleman, Robert Cohen, in Mondo Weiss, writing Natalie Portman. Dear Natalie Portman, I too was once a liberal Zionist. If you look through what this gentleman says, the intellect and the logic that is clearly in this gentleman's mind as he's writing Natalie Portman is unassailable. This guy, in his youth, that the bad guys in Zionism were Begin and Yitzhak Shamir. We just finished mentioning both of those. Both former Jewish terrorists during the British Mandate. They were involved in authorizing a lot of terrorism later, but this isn't mentioned here, of course. But Mr. Cohen says that he refused to accept their Likud party take on Zionism, that was really Zionism as he, Robert Cohen, understood it. Cohen goes on to tell Natalie Portman that he admires the cultural Zionism of Ahad Ha'am, whom I'm not familiar with, from the early 20th century. I believed in the socialist Zionism, he says, that had built the kibbutz movement. I love the binational Zionism of the 30s and 40s, promoted by Judah Magnus, Martin Buber, and Henrietta Zold. This was the Zionist thinking I could feel at home with, says Robert Cohen. But then I looked deep, he says to Portman. I studied, I read, I asked. More importantly, I listened to Palestinian voices for the first time. What I discovered, Mr. Cohen says to Natalie Portman, is that it's not the politicians or the policies that are the problem in Israel. It's the ideology they follow. The cultural Zionism of Ahad Ha'am was beautiful, but he was admired rather than taken up. Socialist Zionism, says Robert Cohen to Natalie Portman, was never a socialism for everyone. It was socialism for Jews only. There was never a Muslim or Christian Arab that was allowed to become a member of a kibbutz until one kibbutz allowed one Palestinian Muslim woman to join in 2008. The proclaimed universalism, he says, of Jewish labor lost out to the particularism of Jewish nationalism. And then he goes on to cite all these things that we have talked about or might well talk about on this show, either past or present. But he goes into a lot of the fraud that is behind this notion of liberal Zionism. The foundational principles that governed the state of Israel from the beginning, he does tremendous damage to this fraud of distinguishing between good and bad Zionists and between liberal Zionism and the variety of people, Begin and Yitzhak Shamir. He also goes into all of the current implications of this. And at the very conclusion, he says, yes, Natalie, please snub the Genesis Prize and refuse to go to the ceremony in Israel, but don't do it in the name of liberal Zionism, and don't defend a fictional Israel that deep down embodies your Jewish values. It doesn't, and it never did. You have to push past it if you want to protect the Jewish values that matter to you. Sincerely, Robert Cohen. This is incredibly powerful stuff, folks, which is why we have it up on the big board. And, of course, Mr. Cohen, quite understandably, was not dealing with all the things that we have talked about before on this show that deal with Israel's blatant criminality in various espionage operations and technology theft operations, and in some cases circumstances that have even involved killing, where Israel has attacked the United States and has gotten away with it, ranging from the Levant affair to the Kennedy assassination, the USS Liberty attack. Certainly, we believe that 9/11, it can be demonstrated there was a strong, strong, overwhelming Israeli component to what really happened at 9/11. You have the Pollard spy case, the Promis affair, and it just goes on and on and on. None of that is even mentioned here, but what Robert Cohen does do, I think, so effectively is just zero in on this notion that we have a bad Zionism and a good Zionism, and certainly these guys like Begin and Shamir are not part of the wonderful Zionist movement and ideal from the beginning. When the reality of it is, yes, they were, the hell of it is that that's a part of what Zionism is. It's based in racial supremacism. It is based in religious bigotry from the beginning. And anyone that stands in the way of this notion of greater Israel, as this was envisioned and continues to be envisioned, is going to be stomped on or marginalized or killed, whatever it takes. So I'm going beyond what Mr. Cohen has said with stronger rhetoric, certainly. But nonetheless, Robert Cohen at least does a very admirable job of trying to say to Natalie Portman, I support your decision not to accept this Genesis Prize. You know, you're never going to reconcile your so-called liberalism, Natalie, your respect for universal values and other people's rights and all this other stuff, and maintain that you are still a Zionist, that really Zionism doesn't represent what Netanyahu's doing now or what Begin and Shamir were doing then. I think Robert Cohen just says that's bunk, Natalie. You can't possibly sustain it. You're never going to have any internal peace until you recognize that you're as duped on this as I was.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the wake of the Israeli election and the official results and the official forming of a new cabinet will take a couple of weeks. So this is going to be in the news. It'll be one of the things that people are talking about, and they'll be talking about Israeli politics as if it's kind of like a normal kind of politics, and Israel as it's like a normal country, and not that it's a country that's throughout its history has been run by, frankly, genocidal maniacs and war criminals. But we know that. We'll be talking about it again. I was wondering about shifting gears. I noticed you've
sure.
got an article on the big board at nationalbugle.com. And at the top of the election and politics, Candace Owens in epic confrontation with Ted Lieu at congressional white nationalist hearings. So we've got these hearings on white nationalism. And, they keep showing almost in a loop this scene of marchers at with tiki torches at Charlottesville, in Virginia, and you know, like, okay, how many CVSs were burned and looted due to white nationalists? How many police cars have been trampled on? You know, how many police officers have been shot by white nationalists? I mean, just compare the white nationalists to, say, the very much celebrated Black Lives Matter, for instance, and then whites in general to the whites that the white nationalists are supposedly representing, to the blacks that the Black Lives Matter is supposedly representing. They've made out of whole cloth, fabricated out of whole cloth, this image of white nationalism as some sort of threat. No, this is just our white history. And then we have to sit back and vicariously watch this epic battle between a young black woman who, I guess, is well-meaning and all. She's young. I don't expect her to know a whole lot and make her the best arguments, but, fine, good for her. And this Chinese guy who's, he's fighting on behalf of the Jews this time. I know isn't he the same person who introduced legislation, like, a few years late, calling on, Republicans and Democrats to work together to end the wars? It's like, there would have been a chance to do that 2 years ago. Not anymore. That ship has sailed. Because now Donald Trump is on the... on the Zionist reservation now, but he was off it. So, okay, what do you take away from this whole spectacle of, white nationalism being put on display as the greatest threat to the United States? Because that's what a lot of people are saying. Greater than Islamic terrorism, greater than anything else. It's white nationalism.
Yeah, well, quite clearly all of this is ludicrous. And I think I would open by saying what was said on David Duke's show on Rents today, and that is that when we think of white nationalism, that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So first of all, we have to clarify what is white nationalism. It's not necessarily the same thing as white supremacism, but we have to be careful with our definitions. The media is throwing all of this around, as well as the liberals in this committee throwing around this term white nationalism without necessarily understanding precisely what it is they're talking about or the diversity within that movement, from responsible people to downright kooks that none of us would want to be associated with. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing, I think David Duke has a very valid point. David Duke may be, and I think he feels that he is, and quite rightly so, the premier white nationalist in the United States. He would have been glad, and he said this on the air, he would have been glad to have appeared at this hearing so that Ted Lieu of California, a Democrat from California, and anyone else in that committee could ask him all of the questions that they would want to ask him. Dr. Duke would have been happy to have stayed for as long as they wanted him there. He would have answered all of their questions. And when we were discussing this on the air on Rents, and you part of that chat too, Dr. Slattery, and David Duke says to me, Mark, why do you think they didn't invite me? And I said, that's because they didn't want a repeat of your performance when you carved up Wolf Blitzer on CNN when he interviewed you Iran. Yeah. And they would not want to be dealing with your ability to expose their bad argumentation. And for most importantly, David Duke to be heard by an average American for who he really is and what he currently believes right now. And any questions about his past, he would have been willing to answer so that we would have had a much better understanding and clearer understanding of definitions of what white nationalism is. And there's a lot of variance in that movement between people I respect and people I think are both dangerous and idiotic. But in Dr. Duke's case, he could have defended himself more than well. in regard to answering every question. I think the American people would have had a totally, who have been listening to media lies about Duke for years, would have had the opportunity to say, this man speaking for himself is not the guy I've been hearing about on CNN, especially when they had that guy on the other night from the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center talking about David Duke and saying he said this or that, where after listening to the guy, he never said that entire life, even when he made the mistake of being involved in the Klan as a young person many years ago. He never said that. So that would have been, that's one regrettable aspect of this. And certainly when we get into this whole issue of white nationalism, it is absolutely nonsensical to believe, as the media, the left-wing, largely Jewish, mainstream American media wants us to believe, that white nationalism is the most compelling threat in the United States today. The most compelling threat in the United States today is a totalitarian media takeover of this country by interests that are absolutely in Israel's back pocket. The biggest threat, I believe, to the American people is the threat of any more of these Middle Eastern wars on behalf of Israel to the exclusion of anything else. What is the biggest threat to the American people today is the shutdown of freedom of speech and freedom of people discourse that these folks want, in shutting down anyone that doesn't agree with their largely neo-Marxist line on things like abortion and homosexuality and gay marriage and all the rest of it, and who also talk about Israel's control of American foreign policy and their buying of our elections, mm-hmm. especially since Citizens United versus FEC and all the rest of the things mm-hmm. that Dr. Duke covered on his show on rents earlier. This is the most compelling threat to America. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we deal with what you brought into this, Dr. Slattery, the crime statistics. The crime statistics in this country, the FBI's own statistics, don't support this notion.
Yeah, and I'm just going to say, I've gone through this on a couple of shows in the past couple of weeks, that if you're looking at murder, you're looking at rape or robbery or burglary, and you look at the 2017 or 2016 FBI data, what is considered hate crimes in those various categories typically make up less than 0.01%.
There you go.
Of the crime. Okay, we're coming up on the break, but we'll be right back. welcome back to the show. So on the subject of white nationalism, you know, I wasn't raised with any kind of white identity, really. And so it's not anything that comes naturally to me. I don't really think of myself as a white nationalist per se, but I do think that a kind of white nationalism is absolutely necessary right now. So I'm a supporter of it. And because white people are under such an attack, and they're under attack by a Jewish-led elite that, in my words, is trying to ride the zombie corpse of white America to world domination, which is bad for everybody. And I think without a kind of nationalism, a kind of identity, white people aren't going to shrug off this this Jewish-dominated elite that has nefarious ends. And so I think certainly as a means to a better ends, a certain kind of white nationalism is absolutely necessary. Anyway, I'm kicking it over to you now.
Yeah, just so we just have a couple minutes to go, as I understand it, I wanted to point to other news on the big board. Reconstruction and Recreation. Brian McClanahan from the Abbeville Institute. That deals with a real history of Reconstruction after the so-called Civil War in this country. Take a look at that. You're not going to learn that information, folks, in today's oriented public school. We've posted the best bookstore in all 50 states from Mental Floss. For those of you who like reading, that comes to us from Mental Floss today. Some fascinating information there. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson tells us from Russia Insider why Putin's Christian faith is most likely authentic. And then, of course, something that goes back to our previous show together, on this whole subject of Christian Zionism, a very fine gentleman by the name of Sam, who listens to our show regularly, was reminding me that I really met William E. Blackstone the other day, not William E. Gladstone, who was the Prime Minister of Britain in the 19th century. William E. Blackstone, and the piece on him as the father of Christian Zionism is found at the Journal of Evangelical Theological Society's December 10 issue. Jonathan Moorhead is the author, and I was able to find, and later Sam sent me the same link, to what I have here in my library, which is how I knew who Blackstone was. I was reading this paper when I was in graduate school at Westminster. We have a pristine PDF file. It's a 14-page read. It's a pristine PDF from the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society, William E. Blackstone, the father of Christian Zionism, question mark. That is a powerful piece, and certainly it underscores not only the fact that powerful Zionist forces were at work many, many decades before Natalie Portman recognizes that they were, but that these forces are still active as well today. William E. Blackstone, you can't analyze modern Zionism as a phenomenon without going back to him as the father of Christian Zionism, and certainly as the full-blown version of Christian Zionism. Look at who this man was, and one understands today's role of the Christian religious right and being overwhelmingly pro-Zionist and pro-Israel, which I think feeds into certain deceptions that Jesus talks about in the Olivet Discourse. But nonetheless, understanding the role of William E. Blackstone and who he knew and how many of these dispensationalist schools he basically financed and founded, including the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. This is important historical reading, and it's there on the big board.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, we are out of time, but as always, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for what you do on nationalbugle.com.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.